This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 3rd, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
They need to look at the eyes in the eyes of members of my administration and hear them say that not only is this president resolved, but America is resolved to rout out terrorism.
Saudi Arabia gives the U.S. a thumbs down to using its military base to attack Afghanistan. A report from Cairo on the number two man in the Taliban after Osama bin Laden.
There was no problem in blowing up a cafe full of such people, with the idea that if you were a pious Muslim in their, according to their standards, you had nothing to worry about. You were going straight to heaven.
And students storm the office of Senator Dianne Feinstein for a bill she plans to introduce. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some members of Congress and the AFL-CIO marched in solidarity today to call for immediate help for the tens of thousands in the airline industry who have been laid off since the September 11th attacks. Mike McDonald reports from the Capitol.
New legislation called the Displaced Worker Assistance Act has been introduced to Congress that would provide an undisclosed amount of money for income support, job training, and health care benefits to the laid-off employees. Senator Paul Wellstone from Minnesota stated his goals for when the bill reaches the Senate floor.
There is no doubt in my mind that we will be on the floor and we will have the amendments which will provide the assistance to the workers and their families, and we will not stop fighting until we get the help to hard-working families all across our country.
The protest was in response to actions taken by Congress and the airline industry. Congress, within 2 weeks of the attacks, allocated $15 billion for airline industry bailout without any money being designated for workers who were laid off. Additionally, the airline industry was asked to increase its security measures. Protesters questioned how these security efforts could be met without experienced and knowledgeable workers to do them. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Mike McDonald.
Senators debated how far they would go to prevent terrorism while maintaining constitutionally guaranteed liberties. More from Ellen Ratner in D.C.
Senators and witnesses alike have stated the importance of striking a balance between giving law enforcement the tools it needs to combat terrorism and assuring that Americans will maintain their civil liberties. Professor David Cole of Georgetown University Law School said that some provisions of the bill are unconstitutional, especially those allowing the government to detain foreign nationals for up to a week without filing charges.
There are very serious constitutional problems with authorizing any detention without charges beyond 48 hours. The Supreme Court has said 48 hours is the limit, and yet this statute would give the Attorney General the authority to hold without charges for 7 days.
Senator Orrin Hatch has countered such claims by referring to Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who wrote that Americans' constitutional freedoms have been slightly limited in times of emergency at many times in American history without what he called any negative long-term repercussions. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ellen Ratner.
In a move designed to slightly chip away at the staunch anti-choice laws in Ireland, a proposal to let the people decide about abortion is being debated. Orla Rappel has more from Ireland.
The Irish government published a proposed amendment to the Constitution that would create a basis for the legislative protection of human life in pregnancy. As a result, the Irish Republic could face a new referendum on abortion early next year. The government intends to ensure the protection of the unborn human life while at the same time ensuring a pregnant woman will receive any necessary medical treatment to protect her life. The Irish Prime Minister, Bertie Ahern, pointed out that if this new law were passed, it would protect both women and the unborn in pregnancy. Mr. Ahern added that in a small number of cases, medical procedures needed to protect the life of the pregnant woman could result in the ending of the life of the unborn. The new law defines abortion in a way that, quote, clearly excludes such ethically legitimate procedures from being termed an abortion. Orla Rappel, Ireland, for Free Speech Radio News.
In Brazil, a proposal is moving through the National Congress to establish racial quotas for universities and some industries. From Rio de Janeiro, Josh Chafin reports.
Brazilians of various races have been intermarrying for 500 years. Regardless of their appearance, the vast majority have some African ancestry, including President Fernando Henrique Cardoso. But a government study prepared for last month's racism summit in South Africa found that black Brazilians make up only about 2% of the university population and 5% of government employees. The proposal to establish racial quotas has gained ground in Congress as a result of the study. Some lawmakers say quotas should even be extended to television and movie acting jobs. Opponents say attitudes will change as Brazil becomes an increasingly diverse society, but some form of racial justice legislation looks likely to pass in the coming weeks. Josh Chapin, Free Speech Radio News, Rio de Janeiro.
And finally, Russia and Iran have signed a deal that would give the former Soviet Republic much-needed cash and Iran much-desired weaponry. The deal has been in the works for a year, but now takes on new meaning. Russia has been a strong supporter of U.S. actions in the Middle East, but the U.S. considers Iran to be a supporter of terrorism. Besides the $300 million worth of jets, missiles, and other weapons, Iran will also get two 100-megawatt nuclear power stations from Russia, expected to be built on the Persian Gulf. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. bombed Iraq again today in the third such strike in 6 days. This even as Saudi Arabia officials told the Bush administration they will not allow the U.S. to use a key Persian Gulf military base as a staging ground for retaliatory strikes against Afghanistan or Iraq. The main base in Saudi Arabia for U.S. forces is Prince Sultan Air Base, which includes a combat operations center from which U.S. commanders could direct airstrikes in the Gulf region. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is set to arrive in Riyadh later today for talks with the Saudi royal family. It's part of a four-nation trip that will also include Egypt and Uzbekistan. Jeremy Scahill has more.
It's being called the precursor to U.S. attacks. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld kicked off a 4 to 5 day visit to the Middle East and Central Asia today. He's making last-minute preparations for Washington's coming war. It's reminiscent of Dick Cheney's trip to the region as Secretary of Defense under Bush's father, just days before the launch of the Gulf War. His first stop is Saudi Arabia. He will also travel to Oman, Egypt, and the Central Asian Republic of Uzbekistan. All of these countries have pledged varying levels of support to Washington. Rumsfeld says he will not be negotiating with any governments, but will be discussing intelligence sharing, as well as finalizing plans for operating bases that will be used to launch the attacks.
There will be a variety of opportunities for countries to work with us in different ways, at different times, in different parts of the world, sometimes visibly and sometimes less visibly.
As Rumsfeld's plane touched down in Saudi Arabia, President Bush was in New York today meeting with corporate CEOs. After the meeting, Bush outlined what he sees as the purpose of Rumsfeld's visit.
Secretary Rumsfeld went over to visit with the leaders of a group of nations to share with them information, to discuss the determination of our nation. People need to be able to look us in the eye and know that when we say that we're in this for the long run, that we're going to find terrorism and bring terrorists and bring them to justice, we mean it. That this is a nation. See, it's hard for people around the world to understand the resolve of America. They may hear my speech occasionally, but they need to look at the eyes in the eyes of members of my administration, because hear them say that not only is this president resolved, but America is resolved to rout out terrorism, to make sure that legitimate governments can survive as we head into the 21st century, and to make a strong stand for freedom. And Secretary Rumsfeld is going to do a fine job of delivering that message.
Meanwhile, another seemingly desperate call today from the Taliban for negotiations with Washington over Osama bin Laden. The only Taliban official with access to the outside world, its ambassador to Pakistan, once again spoke in broken English, as he said his government does not want war. Taliban Ambassador Abdul Salam Zaif.
We condemn the terrorism and terrorism activities, but we need to the evidence, we need to the proof, which is the good way for the solving of problems.
There is now increasing talk of extending Bush's war on terrorism to overtly plotting the overthrow of foreign governments. There are reports of debates within the administration over plans to topple the government of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. This talk of overthrowing Arab or Islamic governments is angering many throughout the Muslim world, where protests are on the rise. According to the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld will not be going to Pakistan because of rising anti-U.S. sentiment there. Again today, thousands of Pakistanis took to the streets of Karachi to protest Bush's so-called war on terrorism.
This battle is not against Osama bin Laden. This battle is not against Mullah Muhammad Umar. This battle is not against Afghanistan. This battle is against Islam and for the whole Muslim nation.
With Donald Rumsfeld in the Middle East and the Bush administration saying there will be no negotiations, it appears as though Afghanistan will soon be attacked. But many questions still loom. Will the Taliban survive the attacks? And what other countries could find themselves on Washington's target list? For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
International aid agencies are predicting a humanitarian disaster in Afghanistan should the United States attack. As Martha Baskin reports, the country was already on the brink of famine when airplanes rammed into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Even in normal times, according to the UN's World Food Program, pre-famine conditions are visible throughout Afghanistan. 23 years of war and 3 years of drought have caused 3.8 million people to be dependent on food aid and positioned Afghanistan as the poorest country in all of Asia. UN spokesperson Abby Smith.
We understand that an early winter is approaching Afghanistan in November, and therefore on September 6th, right before the terrorist attacks, the World Food Program announced a new appeal to donor governments around the world, asking countries to provide funds to help us feed up towards 5.5 million people.
But after the attack, all food shipments were abruptly stopped. On September 12th, international staff from UN agencies and various NGOs, according to Smith, were told by the authorities, or the Taliban, that their safety could no longer be guaranteed. White House officials were initially opposed to any special effort to send aid, arguing that it would fall into the hands of the Taliban. Oxfam, the international humanitarian aid organization, has been working in Afghanistan for 12 years.
Disaster doesn't, it's not good public relations for the American-led campaign.
Alex Renton, with Oxfam's regional office in Islamabad.
I don't think anybody wants to see the starving of millions of Afghans. The United Nations is now saying, and we'd have to concur with this, that 25% of the population are at risk of famine over the coming winter. So in the end, you have to weigh up the evils. I mean, obviously no one wants to feed the armies. And indeed, the evil people. But there are huge numbers of innocent people, as innocent as anyone who's frightened about all this all around the world, who have suffered 20 years of war and drought and devastation, who are looking death in the face at the moment. And we believe that it's our job to try and help them.
Renton says Oxfam has 140 staff in the country who are very good at monitoring where food goes and making sure it goes to the right people. Asked whether the Taliban had been interfering or had a history of interrupting food shipments, Renton replied,
"There's no evidence of that. Certainly the Taliban have closed down some of our offices and the United Nations offices, particularly in Kabul and Kandahar. Arguably that's more for security reasons. We've no confirmed reports of looting of food by Taliban. There is one confirmed report of looting of food in the rebel-held area in Mazar-e-Sharif, but apparently, and indeed they looted the United Nations office. Apparently that was ordinary thieves and bandits."
In a weekly press briefing, a spokesperson for the UN Secretary General said that the World Food Program's control of food stocks in Kandahar had been restored and that the agency found no signs that stocks had been looted. As of yesterday, the UN resumed a small portion of food shipments, 500 tons, compared to 30,000 tons normally distributed on a monthly basis. Again, Oxfam's Alex Renton.
We're looking at a horrific disaster. I mean, it's still away. It's still a few weeks ahead, but it has every potential of happening. But people are talking about 1.6 million people at starvation point by December. We are pleading that the United Nations starts full reshipment of food, which our staff can then, who say they're able and up to do it, can then distribute in Afghanistan.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
Over the last few days, intelligence and congressional sources have suggested the United States will pursue a policy of eliminating charismatic radical leaders throughout the Muslim world. The second name on the list, after Osama bin Laden, is likely to be that of 50-year-old Egyptian doctor Ayman al-Zawahiri, a bespectacled surgeon who planned attacks on the Egyptian government, the Soviet Union, and now the United States. Steve Negus reports from Cairo.
Ayman al-Zawahiri may or may not have had anything to do with the 11th September attacks on the United States. However, he is a longtime associate of Osama bin Laden, and he is believed to have authorized the bombings of the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania 3 years ago, which left over 200 people dead. Hisham Qassam, president of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, says that Zawahiri is primarily known as an ideologue.
We have nothing to point out that he's a military commander. He's responsible for recruiting a lot of young people, his thoughts and his writings. But military capability, nobody has established that yet.
Like bin Laden, Zawahiri was born to a wealthy family. From the age of 15, he was active in the Islamist movement to transform Egypt into a stricter and more Puritan Islamic state. The majority of Islamists join groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood, which has tried to work peacefully within the system. Others joined Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya, or the Islamic Group, which was prepared to use violence but concentrated on building a mass movement. Zawahiri joined a small clandestine group called Jihad, which plotted a coup d'etat. It has probably never numbered more than a few hundred members. In the 1980s, the Egyptian government decided to try and get the radicals off its hands by sending them off to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Zawahiri heeded the call and has not been seen in Egypt since. Afghan veterans began returning home to Egypt in the late 1980s, and armed conflict broke out soon after. Jama'a groups targeted security officers and, to a lesser extent, tourists, so as to harm the Egyptian economy. Zawahiri's jihad planned assassinations of officials, but was also associated with terror bombings in the heart of Cairo.
If a bomb went off, we knew it was jihad, killing indiscriminately. But Jama'a never resorted to bombs. They used Kalashnikovs or used guns in order to take out specific targets rather than kill indiscriminately. The Jama'a believed in spreading the word, well, peacefully, if we may say. Their argument was they resorted to arms in retaliation for what the government was doing to them. But the jihad never believed in spreading the word. They believed in the coup.
The security forces were much stronger than the Islamist bands, however, while the civilian population was appalled by the extent of the violence. By the late 1990s, the militants were all but crushed. Their last known major operation in Egypt was the massacre of tourists at Luxor 4 years ago, which shocked and disgusted even the armed militants themselves. Many of Zawahiri's former colleagues have since renounced the armed struggle against the Egyptian government. Zawahiri, then living with bin Laden in Afghanistan, continued his campaign of violence, but against a new target. Zawahiri has signed bin Laden's World Islamic Front Statement of Jihad Against Jews and Crusaders, which calls for the killing of Americans, both military and civilians. A defector from bin Laden's organization has claimed that Zawahiri sits on the Fatwa Committee responsible for giving religious approval to the group's operations. When the bombs hit the African embassies 3 years ago, both Egyptian and American analysts suspected that Zawahiri had authorized the attacks to retaliate against the CIA for extraditing a jihad leader to Egypt from the Balkans. A statement from Jihad had threatened the United States with a response in language they will understand. The majority of the victims, however, were Africans. Specialists say that Jihad's particular ideology shows little regard for the lives of bystanders, Muslim or non-Muslim alike.
As far as Jihad was concerned, you had 1,400 years since the message came down. If you did not get it by now, you are an object. There was no problem in blowing up a cafe full of such people. With, Taban, the idea that if you were a pious Muslim in their, according to their standards, you had nothing to worry about. You were going straight to heaven.
Zawahiri's name has been mentioned by Israeli intelligence sources and others in connection to the 11th September attacks. Many Egyptians, however, remain unconvinced that either bin Laden or Zawahiri had anything to do with them. Even President Mubarak has called upon the United States to provide proof before any retaliatory strike. That proof has yet to be made public. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Steve Negus in Cairo.
The Indian government has issued an ultimatum to Pakistan after Monday's suicide attacks in the state assembly in Kashmir, which left 38 people dead. The attack was claimed by the Jaish-e-Mohammed, a Pakistani-based group. As Sputnik Colombi reports from the Indian capital, rising Indo-Pakistan tensions can undermine the coalition Washington is trying to build in its war against terrorism.
Already there are calls for revenge, despite Islamabad's condemnation of Monday's suicide attack. Kashmir Chief Minister Farooq Abdullah squarely blamed Pakistan for the attack and vowed retribution. Indian police said all four militants killed in the attack were Pakistani nationals. Ironically, the attack, which was allegedly aimed at the, quote, puppet regime in Srinagar, did not kill a single politician. 18 of the 38 victims were civilians. The attack was one of the worst since the insurgency began 12 years ago and took security personnel completely by surprise. Bashir Manzar, editor of Kashmir Images, a Srinagar-based publication.
September 11, when this terror attack on America, there was a lull for quite some time, and the people analyzed it in this way that the Kashmiri militants were watching American reaction, in fact. They were apprehensive of America targeting Kashmiri groups also. But after 7-8 days when they saw American food that they are not going to touch Kashmiri militant groups, so they have come up big bang.
India says its patience is running out and has demanded that the U.S. ban and freeze the accounts of Pakistani-based groups such as the Jaish-e-Mohammed, responsible for Monday's attack, and the Lashkar-e-Toiba. Washington, it says, should pressure Islamabad to turn off the taps of terrorism. But the United States has made it clear that its targets are groups with global reach. The two groups mentioned are both India-specific. Dr. Shanta Nedangadi Varma teaches international relations at Delhi University and says India should tackle the Kashmir problem on its own.
I feel that India's strategy should be her own strategy, and we should not be really running to the U.S. for help, because right now, yes, there is a convergence of interest as far as the United States and India are concerned about international terrorism. And it would be in India's long-term interest to see the United States deal with terrorist organizations in Afghanistan, because they are close linkages.
New Delhi has warned Pakistan and the United States that its restraint should not be taken for granted. But, argues Dr. Varma, India has very few options. Crossing the line of control and engaging the terrorists in so-called hot pursuit will only aggravate the situation.
We do not want war at this point between India and Pakistan, right? If things get to that head, then we are going to have a United States. That is certainly not going to support this kind of a war, because it's got its own stakes in Pakistan far too deep. India's own stakes in the continuance of Musharraf itself is important. That is another factor that we have to remember. A further destabilization of Pakistan at this stage.
It is becoming increasingly clear that a U.S. strike against Afghanistan will not only destabilize Pakistan, but India as well. Bashir Manzar says two scenarios can be envisaged.
It may discourage Kashmiri militant groups, and they may stop these violent tactics for quite some time. But another is that religious fanaticism. Then they can do anything to America, but they can give vent to their anger while attacking Indian installations and other things in Kashmir. So you can expect any kind of horrible thing in coming days.
We can expect more suicide attacks, not just in Kashmir, but elsewhere in India, you think?
Yeah, elsewhere in India. You can't rule out that.
However, like the United States and the rest of the world, India too has come to terms with Parvez Musharraf. But if India's options are limited, says Dr. Varma, Musharraf too is in a tight corner.
I think today Musharraf is on a very sticky wicket. He would not like to be seen as somebody fostering terrorism, even if it is cross-border terrorism, particularly given the situation that it is caught in with the United States pressures on it right now. So we have to really see who is calling the shots as far as Lashkar-e-Taiba is concerned. Is it really Musharraf, or is it these religious extremist groups that are functioning from Pakistan itself?
How clear is India's strategy, do you think?
I have no idea, because I don't know if they have a strategy.
Sputnik Kilambi in New Delhi for Free Speech Radio News.
Over 100 university students turned out at the San Francisco office of Dianne Feinstein yesterday to protest the bill the senator plans to introduce barring international students from entering the United States. If adopted, the proposal would block an estimated 600,000 students from attending college in the U.S. From San Francisco, Richard Levitt reports.
Among the 120 or so people who attended was English exchange student Brioni Greenhill. She thinks the legislation goes too far.
And I just think it's crazy. It's the biggest overreaction available. It's like it's making a war on all of us, not just terrorists.
Lily from La Raza community on the Berkeley campus is concerned that this infringement on civil liberties is just the beginning.
What's next? Okay, we're going to ban the visas for international students for 6 months, and that's it, right? That's all that's going to happen. The international students that are here are not going to suffer, right? Yeah. Yeah, 6 months. You don't know where she's going with this.
Soon after the attack, Senator Dianne Feinstein announced her plans to introduce a bill putting a 6-month moratorium on the student visa program. She says it's to give the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, time to reinforce their system for tracking foreign students. Her plan includes a number of measures for tracking students and integrating that information with the INS, the FBI, State Department, and Customs. Hani Hanjour, one of the hijackers on the flight that hit the Pentagon, was reportedly in the country on a student visa allowing him to study at Holy Names College in Oakland. Many school administrators support improved tracking. Just the same, none who responded for this report felt that the senator's proposed bill was addressing the issue in a rational way. Judy Grieg, a senior advisor to the president at Notre Dame University in Belmont, says the policy is misdirected.
The number of student visas that are issued are very small compared to the number of visas issued. And to just choose a category, international students, where you're building goodwill and cooperation in the world and shut those down, just seems like a knee-jerk reaction.
Students share the concern. Miriam Garavi is a student at UC Berkeley.
This bill would also apply to professors. It would apply to pretty much citizens from all countries, you know, and let's not forget that in the World Trade Center bombing, there were at least 60 countries that lost citizens, and this kind of collective punishment isn't really solving anything.
The Stop the War Coalition expects Senator Feinstein to introduce the legislation in about 2 weeks. With Kelia Ramirez, this is Richard Levitt for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and 4 continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 1-510-287-5551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, J. Patch Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.